MacCast, Sunday, June 19th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, you may or may not be able to tell that I am recovering from a little bit of laryngitis. Probably one of the worst things that could happen to a podcaster is to lose his voice. So maybe some of you like the sound, maybe you don't. I feel like a little bit like Froggy from The Little Rascals, to tell you the truth. So in today's episode, what I did was I actually am bringing you an interview. And I conducted the interview earlier today with a guy who you may have run across his writing recently. He got some really big press on an article he wrote for Medium. I think I maybe even talked about it on the MacCast, talking about some of Apple's acquisitions in the area of artificial intelligence, machine learning, those sorts of things, specifically the acquisition of Vocal IQ, and more specifically how it related to Siri and maybe some of the things that we were going to see at WWDC. The guy's name is Brian Romley, and I reached out to him because I was really impressed with his writing and then learned a little bit more about his work and stuff like that. And turns out he went to WWDC. He saw all the announcements regarding Siri and Apple Pay and some of the other things that Apple is working on. And I really wanted to get him in and get his opinions and thoughts on everything that went down as it relates to his work and the things that he is doing now. And so I think it's a great interview. I had a great time talking to Brian, and I really hope you enjoy it. And it's going to help me get through and maybe give my voice a little bit of a rest. So stay tuned for that in a moment. But before we get into that, I do need to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. And that sponsor is Atlassian. Today, nearly anything is possible. And if we can dream it, teams can build it. So how do you bring everyone together to create what's next? Well, you team up with Atlassian. They are makers of collaboration software that lets teams work together and communicate better. They have a number of products, a whole suite, if you were, and they handle just about everything that you would need to do if you're doing development, management of anything related to a team. So you have Jira, which is going to allow you to assign and track and manage tasks for your project. Doesn't matter how complex it is. Then they have Confluence that allows you to create and share your content, organize the results, and bring team members up to speed. For communication, they have HipChat. It's instant messaging, video chat, audio chat with your team from any device, anywhere in the world. And then for coding projects, managing all that code, testing, review, doing all that stuff in real time, they have Bitbucket. And it's all together under Atlassian. And I've used Bitbucket myself on a project to work with a remote team. It was fabulous. It made it so easy for me to collaborate. More importantly, to track and see changes that other people were making, to deploy and test my code. And it was a huge benefit to the project because seeing all those changes others were making, even though we were working remotely, we weren't in the same room, we were working at different times, it made it easy for me to solve any code conflicts or problems that might have come up very quickly and easily. And then you combine that with Atlassian's other powerful tools, and it's a huge advantage to your team. So I think a big advantage of the Atlassian tools as opposed to other things is rather than getting them in piecemeal from separate companies, they're all under the Atlassian umbrella. So you're getting all those services from a single source, meaning you get a consistent user experience for your team across a range of tools that integrate well together, from project management to tracking to communication, content sharing, code management. It's all in one place. And also you're dealing with one source for billing and support as well. So makes it that much simpler to work with your stuff. You don't have to take my word for it. You can visit Atlassian.com, that's Atlassian.com, to see how Jira, Confluence, HipChat, and Bitbucket give your team everything you need to organize, discuss, and complete shared work. Atlassian, helping teams everywhere team up to create what's next. And a big thank you to Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. So I'm not going to make you suffer through my scratchy voice anymore. Let's just dive right into my conversation with Brian Romley.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Wonderful. How you doing, Adam?
I'm doing great.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a longtime fan, so nervous to be on your show, actually. So,
well, I don't be nervous at all. We'll make this as painless as possible. I am a new fan of your work. I have to be honest. I found out about what you were doing from your recent Medium post that kind of got some play. The thing on about Vocal IQ, the company that Apple had acquired, and some of the commerce. But then I've been digging into all the work that you've been doing, and that immediately wanted me to get you on the show, because I'm thinking you can help us out with sort of the future of voice and Siri and Apple Pay and commerce and all that stuff. Your background is amazing.
Well, thank you. Yes, look how far we've come in like 3 weeks, where Apple was being pronounced as being not even close to being involved in artificial intelligence. And I saw those postings and I said, hold up, folks, they acquired Perceptio and Vocal IQ and Emotient. And these companies are profoundly important for what the future of artificial intelligence is going to be in machine learning. So, yeah, I kind of rolled that out, and I thought it was a nerd fest. I didn't figure many people were going to notice it, because I've been writing on Quora.
Right, I saw that, yeah.
For, you know, 5-8 years, really, I haven't blogged a lot, but Quora the last 5 years pretty heavily. And, I predicted early Apple Pay before it came out because of patents. I love reading patents. And I've been reading patents from Apple since the 70s. So it was pretty easy for me to telegraph that. But with AI, it was harder, because Apple hasn't filed a tremendous number of AI patents. And so it was pretty easy, I guess, for some of the bloggers to start attacking them, especially after the Google approach was announced at Google I.O. It made Apple look quite different.
Well, and then there was the whole Viv thing, right? So they get a lot of flack because those are the guys from Siri. And it's like, well, why haven't you done this stuff inside Siri?
Exactly. And Dag and Adam, who were part of the original Siri team, who left and built the nucleus of Viv down in San Jose. You know, there is a lot of inside stories about why this took place. But I can tell you, just from my perspective, that one of the last really important things that Steve Jobs thought that he did before his untimely passing on was to acquire Siri. I mean, it was so important while he was sick. He made the call to Dag on his phone, his iPhone, which he almost didn't get to answer because the slide switch wasn't working on the screen. He basically said, this is as important as the user experience I created with the Macintosh and also with the gesturing of touchscreen. So he saw it as profoundly important. That translation over the last 5 years, really, since they made the acquisition, probably a little too slow for most people, even myself. Right. And I think we're seeing that in Viv. Viv is taking a dramatically different direction from a programming experience, from a developer experience, than Siri and Alexa is. So, so that's a big fork in the road.
So I think where I want to start with you, just for people who maybe aren't familiar, because like I said, I've been digging in a little bit into your background and the Quora thing, and we'll definitely link to all those Quora articles, because there's a ton of them and there's a great wealth of information. So I'll put that in the show notes for people. But where I wanted to start out with is maybe with a little bit of your background, because I think you kind of started out in the commerce side and more recently started moving into the voice side. So a little bit of your background, and then I want to hit on, you know, what's happening with Siri, because I know you were at WWDC and had some exciting conversations and met developers and talked to those folks. And so talk about Siri and the developments there, and then maybe get into how that applies to potentially Apple Pay and talk about some of the Apple Pay things and stuff that are going on, because I think that's really in your wheelhouse, that commerce stuff. So, you've been doing this stuff for a long time. So can you tell people a little bit about, you know, sort of your path to where you are now?
Oh boy, Adam, I'll try to do it very quickly.
Yeah.
I really
just hit the highlights.
Yeah, I grew up near Princeton, New Jersey, and I spent a whole lot of time around Princeton at the university and at the Institute of Advanced Study. My background was originally going to be physics. I thought I was going to be a physics researcher, whether it was going to be what is now deemed as quantum physics or planetary physics was one of my big deciding points. I took a bit of a detour from that. I'm still actively involved in that as a perhaps an amateur, if you will. Mm-hmm. I it's one of my passions. And it was actually a conversation at the Institute of Advanced Study, which I was just a young kid there, that led me into becoming a programmer and much deeper into software than hardware. Because prior to that, I was really a soldering gun guy and analog electronics and early digital electronics. This is the 1970s era. And so I kind of got out of the physics, even though, you know, I liked it. I started developing software. Long story short is I built a point of sale system, one of the very first, actually for that era, it was on a PC platform for a lot of reasons. And I sold that company and I moved out west because the West seemed to be more of an interesting area for me. I settled just north of where you are in an area of Temecula, California. And I've always been passionate about the programming side. But on top of that, I got very involved in payments. I studied payment history down to Sumerian culture up until recent culture and the whole symbolic nature of what payments represent to us in our life. So, you know, I always was a bit of a coder, but I kind of let it go for a while. And I spent a lot of time consulting with bankers and most recent last 8 years, a lot of startups about payments and what is now known as Apple Pay and some of these other ideas. And most recently, my coding experience was reactivated when I taught myself Xcode over the period of last summer, basically Xcode when it applies to iOS. And I put together something called PayFinders. And PayFinders is an Apple Pay, the largest Apple Pay map in the world. It's actually the largest NFC map in the world, but I'm an Apple fanboy, and I don't, I'm not shy admitting it, so I primarily see it as an Apple Pay locator. What PayFinders does is it allows you to find retail locations that actually accept Apple Pay. It's a dynamically updated application as far as the data. It's crowdsourced to a certain degree. You get to vote on locations and suggest them, and it's been consistently in the top 200 in the App Store, and there's a lot of interest, let's say, internally at Apple and Google on this data set that I've been able to acquire.
Yeah, it's an amazing app. I made it a pick not long ago, so hopefully most MacCast listeners know about it. But those who don't, you know, what I love about it is it's not just finding the location. Well, two things that really appealed to me with what you did is, one, that it's very regionalized. So when you open the app, you know, it's just the Apple Pay locations that are near me, because that's what I'm going to really care about at that moment. And then the second thing was that it's not just about the payment stuff. And I think this goes to some of your history. And I'm going to ask you to expand on this a little bit, because it's about the retail experience as well. So it's not just that you crowdsourced, hey, they take Apple Pay. I mean, that would be great in and of itself. But I can also sort of comment on the experience, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
So that adds that data set. And I know you kind of glossed over the earlier work, you know, the point of sale system you did, but the point of sale system you put together, from what I read on your Quora stuff, is it wasn't just about taking the payment, right? It was about more about the tracking and the experience and you know, the whole picture.
Absolutely, Adam. Thank you. You know, back in that early era, it was extraordinary for a merchant to have a computer in their retail environment. In fact, as we exist here in 2016, it's still extraordinary to see a computer in some small merchants. And that befuddles a lot of people. I have a lot of reasons. It's called a philosophy I've learned after 30 years of dealing with small and medium-sized merchants. I call it the practical and pragmatic philosophy. Now, I'm a nerd, right? I love technology. But being with merchants for 30 years, you understand the other side of this, and that's called practical and pragmatic. And these two worlds are hard to meet, especially in business-to-business environments. Mm-hmm. But what I knew back in those early days is, even though merchants instinctively, if they were successful, the Darwinian example of success is they are instinctively aware of what their business is doing because you're competing with much larger, higher financed companies. And you go to the small taco shop or you go to the small cafe that is across the street from Starbucks or some other national chain. And if they're there for 5 years, they are the Darwinian dictionary example of success because they're fighting immense odds to be successful. And so I learned from them and I said, well, let me give you your data back. And what I found out pretty early, and it's very heartbreaking to new startups, is that merchants really didn't care about the data that much. And I tried as I will to make the data useful and, you know, put it all out. And then I ran into the chief data scientist for the QuickBooks product. And that cleared my head. This was back in the mid-90s, late 90s. And he said, you know, the least used aspect of QuickBooks is the data visualization. And up until the last, about 3 years ago, that is still the case. So as much as they try to update data visualization, small merchants didn't care. And so I bring that experience when it comes to with this, all of this new technology and how it relates to commerce, because basically a lot of this technology ultimately will be related to commerce. When it comes to Apple, when it comes to Google, it's going to be related to advertising. So the two companies have profoundly different views on how these systems will monetize themselves ultimately. We can kind of cover that. But I sort of run astray here. But basically, my premise is that Apple Pay experience in the retail environment is irresistible. And once the user experiences it and once the merchant experiences it in its ultimate form, you don't want to go back, especially with the EMV card, chip card failure that I was projecting a couple of years back. It was a step backwards. Everybody thinks, well, we have these computers on the chips, chips on the cards or computers. No, this is 1970s technology. And it was designed because phone calls cost too much and the cards had to self-authorize. That's the only reason they put a chip on the card. Later on, it became a security feature for cloning of a card, but it did nothing about encrypting the data. EMV does not encrypt data. It just stops you from cloning cards, not entirely, but to a greater extent. Now that fraud is now going online, unfortunately, more than in retail space. But Apple Pay encrypts data. It creates a tokenization, a stand-in for your existing credit card. And the retailer is happy because they have less fraud. You're happy because you have less fraud. And the system hums along. And right. That's why it was an easy sell to banks. Everybody says, oh, bankers have to give up maybe perhaps 15 basis points, you know, right. 0.15. And the reality is Apple's saving them probably an order of magnitude more than 15 basis points potentially in fraud as it continues to be this wild success that it has become.
Right. Well, okay, so I have a question for you there because you mentioned the data sets and retailers maybe not being all that interested in. But you also mentioned the advantages to moving to like a system like Apple Pay for retailers in terms of the fraud. Something that I've been curious about, and I know you listen to the show, so you've probably heard me talk about many times, is I think Apple's done a great job of getting banks and credit card companies on board with Apple Pay. But it seems like there's a lot of pushback from the retailers, at least from a consumer perspective. So maybe I don't fully understand what's going on behind the scenes. So is there a behind the scenes reason beyond just retailers being resistant to change that's affecting like the adoption of even just the chip cards? You know, because you go into a merchant now and they're blocked or they say, oh, don't use it. And it's like, well, you have the reader. Why aren't you using this technology?
Well, there's a whole soup of ingredients there.
Well, what are kind of the high point? You know, what are the main obstacles that...
So.
We're seeing, and more specifically, how does it relate to, like, why is Apple Pay seem to have such pushback from the retail side? It feels that way as a consumer. Maybe that's not what's happening, though.
Yeah, I can see that. So I'm in a unique position. I get to see, although it's filtered because people who download my app, and there's, you know, a lot of people using it, I get to see them. So that's self-selecting. But within that self-selecting group, I'm seeing incredible increased usage of Apple Pay over the last 12 months. I mean, the app literally has only been out officially since November. And, you know, this last weekend, I had more people using Payfinders than I did the entire month of January and February combined. So there is, you know, exponential growth on my end, but I'm also seeing it come across more platforms. The iPhone SE is starting to almost lead this campaign. That means a lot of new adopters of right. iPhone technology are actually getting more attracted to Apple Pay than the initial set. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Now let's go on the retailer side. I have never seen a larger explosion in payments in my entire history of doing this over 35 years. Nothing has even come close to the critical adoption of a new technology than I've seen with Apple Pay. Now, there are some barriers, but it is really coming from the small and medium-sized merchant. Even prior to Square coming out with their card reader, merchants were demanding, calling up their bankers and saying, I need an Apple Pay terminal now. And they were more than willing to, you know, distribute these terminals because Apple wisely did not sidestep anybody from the ecosystem. All other payment paradigms tried to sidestep the existing legacy infrastructure ecosystem. For example, when Square came out with Pay With Your Name, they said, oh, you know, you can't use any other payment system. You have to use Square. Well, some merchants didn't want to move to Square. Therefore, they by that nature, and I tried to tell this to the company, they balkanized how far this technology could reach. Mm-hmm. If I was, you know, sitting next to Jack and he was listening to me, I would say, open it up, open source it. And there's a lot of good reasons why. Nobody listened and it was a waste of time and money. But it was a beautiful system. It just didn't scale as they made it. Apple Pay and Apple had the wisdom to say, everybody is invited to the table. So merchants, small merchants drove this. Small merchant providers drove it. So for most of 2015 and late 2014, you were seeing this immense growth on that level. But on the national level, there's all kinds of politics going on. And it comes down to cost. Right. If you go into a large retail store, they want your PIN number. They want your debit card. They don't really want your credit card. And there's only one reason. There's something called the Durbin Amendment, and Durbin set a limit on how much you can raise the cost of a PIN-based debit transaction. And that allow, and even before that, it was always less costly. And that's why when we go into larger stores, they will constantly ask you, credit or debit, credit or debit. Now, you know you can use your debit card like a credit card without a PIN number. Everybody knows that. Right. But what they're really asking you is, please enter your PIN number so I can save 3.5 cents or a quarter of a penny on this transaction. And as an aggregate, that adds up to billions of dollars in the case of a Walmart. And that's why sure. we see Walmart fighting. So when Apple Pay came around, it didn't have a mechanism for the paradigm of PIN-based debit. Now it will. And that was number one problem. Number two is egos. Walmart was mentally investing in something which is now apparently a failure, and most of us predicted this. It's called MCX, Merchant Credit right. Exchange, Commerce, whatever it was, and something that they called currency. It never really was a product. And the whole mission of that, it was a direct debit to your checking account.
Right.
Now, a little sidestep of my payments background. You and I use credit cards because of the word, and this is a problem with Bitcoin too, because of the word credit. We use credit cards primarily, and even millennials. The reason why millennials are known not to use credit cards is because credit ratings are much different right now because of 2008 and the problem with millennial cost of education. But you know, that's another black hole. But we go back to it. It's credit. We want to be able to buy something today that we'll gladly pay for hopefully next month, but maybe not 10 months. Right. You know, you don't want to buy a dinner today and pay for it for 16 months because that maybe $100 dinner might wind up costing you $700. And that's just the reality of credit. But credit is a flexibility in your budget. So you don't have to worry, do I have $150 in my account right now? I don't want to be embarrassed, so I'll use my credit card. I mean, some people are living very tight to their wallet. And then there are optional experiences that are beyond food and clothing that are just entertainment. Even buying a computer could be considered entertainment. And you don't have $1,200 right now, and so you want to buy it. And you have on-demand credit right there on your Visa or MasterCard or American Express and Discover. So you have that ability. So when you go to retailer products, like some of Target's products and what Walmart wanted to do, those are not credit products or debit products. That means you have to have the money. And and that's why it's a tricky balance for them. They don't want to give up credit entirely because you're not going to buy the flat screen TV from them. Right. You go down the road. But on the smaller commodity purchases, they don't want you to use a credit card. And only recently, legally, could have, they have done this with a number of rulings where they can, what we can call shuttle transactions to different payment types. And it used to be violation of certain rules, state laws, and even some federal guidelines. So that's why they were doing it. And that injured Apple, because Apple was coming at exactly the same time that some of these merchants were praying that their own payment systems that were not consumer-centric, they were merchant-centric. They were solving their problem and not the consumer problem. Apple did it the other way around. Hey, we want to make the payment experience become like the one-click experience on Amazon at retail. And that's right. Exactly what they did. And right. NFC technology carries that. That's the transport.
Yep. Very, very cool. All right. I think I want to move into some of the WWDC and the Siri stuff. So we kind of hit on payments a little bit, and we might come back to it with some of the Apple Pay. I'm gonna back up. Let's hit Apple Pay for web real quick, and then I think we can get into more of the voice and the Siri stuff, which I think is a little bit more interesting at this point. So you spoke to, you know, Apple being consumer centric. Obviously, WWDC, a big announcement was Apple Pay for the web. How was that for you?
Wow, Adam, that was a landmark directional change for payments on the web because of a lot of factors, and something I'm predicting privately with people I work with for pretty much the last 5 years. And it really is, again, Amazon one-click experience to every small, medium, and large website you can imagine.
I thought exactly the same thing. It's interesting that you use those terms, because that was my thought when they announced it as well.
Oh, yes. And what it really means to the small and medium-sized merchant, more than the large merchant, is really the ability to compete with that one-click environment. And that one-click environment isn't just one-click that we know in Amazon. It's that whole ability on how we mediate our credentials in a shopping experience. So let me break this out, because a lot of people haven't really experimented with it, and a lot of the writers aren't really, you know, into payments, understand the nuances. Currently, when you go to a small or medium-sized website, each shopping cart experience is different.
Right.
You know, you never see, even if they're using the same shopping cart software, it's so customizable, you don't know what button does what, and then you have all these other things. So let me just go to that first. Within the new paradigm of Apple Pay for Safari, well, that's the best way I like to term it, because it's really exacting. Apple Pay for Safari is limited. There's no doubt about it. So let's get that out of the way. The limitation is, if you use it inside of a Mac platform, let's call it a MacBook Pro, you're going to have a paired iOS device that has Touch ID and Apple Pay already set up.
Right.
So let's be clear about that. Now, that sounds Rube Goldberg-like, but it'll become more clear as I move on. And that will be eliminated. I'll just say really clearly right now, by the end of this year, we're going to see Touch ID on Mac keyboards. I'm predicting it to be on the MacBook Pro. There's absolutely no doubt about it, and you won't need an iOS device when you're doing Safari web transactions and other types of, you know, Apple Pay transactions, which will come to the Mac platform. So that's clear, and Apple's not going to keep it two devices all the time. That's ridiculous. It's just they're not
got to be open
announcing.
Up, yeah.
Yeah, they're not announcing hardware at a developer show. They did it a couple of times and it wasn't really good. So when you go to a website that has a JavaScript, we'll call it an API. Now, fork in the road, most shopping carts, I talked to 90% of the shopping cart developers, the main ones that are used at most websites, they're all going to implement Apple Pay for Safari. There's no question about it. They know it's powerful. There's no downside. It's very easy. Somebody who can, you know, develop your own website and your own shopping cart, you just drop in the JavaScript code. It self-recognizes the user that has a Safari that has Apple Pay set up. You won't see the Apple Pay buttons unless you have the setup. So it really is excluding those that don't have it. They don't know it's out there. Now, here's where it gets very interesting. It supersedes the shopping cart as we know it. Here's why. Each individual item will have its own Apple Pay button. And it will be very much like an Amazon one click. So if I'm going to a website and I might buy five items, the metaphor we have today, and it sounds good until you really see how it works without it, is that you accumulate your items inside a shopping cart. That seems to be an appropriate metaphor. The problem is the shopping cart is an you're anticipating a final reaction. And that final reaction is what we ultimately see shopping cart abandonment take place. Right. And that is after we go to the shopping cart, we have the accumulation, and then we have, I don't know, $250. We thought we were going to spend $50. So that's the first level of heartbreak in a shopping cart problem. We start seeing people through a lot of data sets over the last 20 odd years start unloading their shopping cart because they accumulated too much. That's the first thing the retailer gets angry over. It's like, why are they dumping everything? The next thing is the barrier to entry to complete the transaction. And there are many. and each one is unique. It's like, are they going to want my billing address? Can I say my billing is the same as my delivery? My CVV2 number? Where is that? Apple Pay has... Apple has iCloud keychains, which will do everything except the CVV2 number. And I still know a lot of people with great memory that don't remember their CVV2 number,
right?
Which makes it almost.
And then you got to go find the card, and
you got to find the card, and then you got to. It doesn't always work brilliantly when you're sharing your contact data, because sometimes the phone number will come out the wrong format. Sometimes the address needs to be on different lines. And if you're international, forget it. It's just a spaghetti mess. So that's where a majority of shopping carts wind up getting dumped in an online experience.
Right. It's that checkout process, right?
That
it's
whole like checkout.
Too many screens, too much data. This is not worth the hassle.
It can be 20 screens. Adam, it can be 20 screens and people are gone. Apple, it's all done. It's flattened with one click. Here's how it works. You go to the item. You can add it to the shopping cart or you can say pay with Apple Pay. A lot of people go, well, I'm not done. It doesn't matter because you can go to another page and pay with Apple Pay too. Apple is becoming a universal shopping basket. And then they will at some point expire that shopping basket and make it into a single transaction for that merchant, and you wind up paying. So I'm not saying if you abandon it and you don't consummate it with your thumbprint, you ain't no shopping cart left. It's gone. That's still going to be abandonment. But when you press your thumb, or finger, whatever, on that first transaction, feel free to continue on. You don't have to. You can keep doing it. That will ultimately be coalesced at that merchant's site as a single transaction, similar to what goes on one click over at Amazon. That is remarkable. Why? Because Apple users now are spared the mess of all the different shopping carts, and Apple is mediating that experience to make it one click. And that's across a vast majority of websites, because I really think it's going to take over like wildfire. Amazon is going to have their version of it. They already do to a certain extent. PayPal has their version. It's not quite the same. And of course, you're going to see Android and Microsoft come up with their version. Those are probably going to be three steps. Android looks like it's going to have to be a three-step process for maybe even patent reasons. Now, that's on a big screen. Now it gets uglier inside of Safari on a small screen. If you have an iPhone SE and you're trying to shop on the web, it is incredibly difficult. You have scroll buttons, you have all this stuff. The Apple Pay experience on Safari is, yes, translated into iOS devices. Many reporters, especially general reporting on CNN and stuff, they didn't talk about this aspect. They just said it's always, Safari on your Mac. And that's good. Yeah. But Safari on your iOS device is even more profound because it is such a smaller screen and it's even that much harder to navigate. And there's even more shopping cart abandonment that's taking place in that environment. So that's going to be eliminated. And what else is happening? There's less fraud. The biggest problem a virtual merchant has, a merchant where they don't physically see the customer, is they're going to get fraudulent credit cards. By definition, that's going to happen almost never on Apple Pay. It is exceedingly difficult to create that type of fraud because you're giving up so much location data, so much, even within Apple's privacy profiles, you still could very well get caught doing this stuff on any massive scale, and you wouldn't do it as a casual. Let's randomly type in this credit card and see if we get this shipment to come. You know,
right.
That kind of stuff. So that's done. What does that mean for the consumer? It means there's less fraud to the merchant. Their prices are going to stabilize or go down. Because some merchants experience such high fraud and of chargebacks, of reversals. I was never at your website. I don't, you know, approve this transaction. Those things are going to be gone. It's going to be hard for people to make the claim even that they didn't authorize this transaction, because that's a big chargeback reason. I never went to this website. I didn't authorize it. Well, hold on. You know, you tokenized it, Apple Pay, you got the thumbprint, you got all this. Nah, we're gonna kick that back, and gonna have to have another reason to charge it back.
Do you think that's even enough for some retailers to incentivize picking one payment method over another? So saying that, hey, look, if you use Apple Pay, we'll give you a discount, or we'll give you a bonus, or we'll give you free shipping, or those sorts of things.
Adam, that's brilliant. Absolutely. The incentivization is going to be, I think, quite large. Probably just because of the psychology behind this, you're going to see choice small merchants that really get it, and some of the very large marquee merchants that wind up announcing full implementation when Apple comes out in the fall. We're going to see some big retailers come into this, and it's going to cross-platform. Because we have to understand that the Apple Pay kit, and we can transition into this, is more than web. It's inside of the new platform environments. Apple is a platform company after WWDC. They, 16, they become a platform company overnight. iMessage, inside of Maps even,
right,
and inside of Siri. And these are three platforms that Apple is champion, Apple Pay, obviously AI, and they cross-pollinate each other because, you know, Siri cross-pollinates into this, Apple Pay and iMessage, all of this stuff, along with continuity, which is another concept that is going to inform Apple Pay. But so the same experience that you have as a consumer inside Apple Pay for Safari, Apple Pay in-app is coming to iMessage. And it sounds like a millennial thing. Oh, I'm not using Snapchat. That's not really what this is about. iMessage is going to become an inroad for more communications, not only to other people, but also inside of your AI or your intelligent assistant. Now, I am a big fan of voice-driven AI. I call this voice first,
right,
the voice first revolution. And that's going to be the predominant thing. In fact, I make this prediction, 50% of all computer interactions in 10 years will be by voice. And I think it'll probably be a conservative prediction. Right now, it sounds outlandish. But there are times when voice doesn't make sense. So your inroad is going to be textual and it'll be within iMessage to a certain extent. But you're also going to be communicating within things that we're now calling domains. They've always been domains, but it's going to become much more prevalent to the common user. A domain is a skill that comes from an app. An app can be a domain, but the app brings a domain. Let's call it, in an example, let's say the app is Pizza Hut, and that domain is pizza, but it could also be wings, unfortunately. So I'm not a big fan, but I'll use Pizza Hut. So sure. Pizza Hut comes in as a domain. Now, where does that domain sit? It sits inside of Siri as an AI event for when I say, hey, Siri, I want a pizza. Okay, you know, Siri is at least Siri that we see today will respond with a limited intent capability. The intent is what one can extract from that domain. So order a pizza is an intent. So the pizza is the domain, the intent is order. And then
right,
there's more intents, what type of taxonomies that it's related to, cheese, pepperoni, and there's a whole ontology that's created around this type of AI that most of us are probably going to tangentially start understanding, because that's how we're going to be interacting with computers. We're not going to say, hey, Siri, scroll up, turn, you know, go right, click on this. It's going to be intent and domain driven based right, on an outcome or an action. So that's where message winds up, the message app store. certainly deserves its own app store. Siri will wind up having its own app store. And certainly Maps will wind up having its own app store for a number of different reasons, because I really believe that silos of usability with inside of these apps are going to become quite prevalent. And it's going to be situational. If you're in message, you're going to deal there. If you're in Maps, you're going to deal there. If you're in the web, you're going to deal there. If you're just in voice, you're going to deal just primarily within Siri. So that's the overview.
Yeah, you're kind of moving into something that, as I've been parsing all the things that happened at WWDC, because I'm having somewhat of a hard time with that word app. I think Apple used that word app because it's familiar to people now, right? Yeah. They pioneered it because it was Messages plus apps and Siri plus apps and Maps plus apps. And that's great. But what I'm realizing now as a whole, and even a lot of the things we just talked about, Apple Pay on the web, it seems to me the overarching theme was Apple setting up, and I think I call it services and infrastructure. You sure. used a different term earlier, but the point is I think Apple is building up for building systems that are going to live in a screenless world or a screen diminished world. So by screen diminished, I'm talking about something like an Apple Watch, right? And yes. So to bring all this functionality, and it's even more at a larger level, it was interesting to me that Apple used that word plus app, because yeah. I think overall the message was the app is going away, right? What's going to happen is you're going to expose your services to our apps, and we're going to be the interface. We're going to be the UI. You're going to be the functionality, or as you mentioned, the domains and the intents, right? But when I'm in apps, I'm going to have certain actions that I want to do. And so those apps, quote unquote apps that are in Maps, are really the things that are like, okay, I'm looking to go somewhere. Now I want to order a ride there. Well, you're going to do Uber from right inside there, or Lyft from inside the Maps app. You're still using, quote unquote, an Uber app. But what is an app when you take the... I think Apple's really showing us this is what an app is when you take the UI away. When you
exactly.
Take, right? And that definitely leads into voice, right? What you're mentioning about people using voice in the future, it's going to be ultimately important that there is no UI. There is no, quote unquote, you know, interface or app with voice, at least as we understand it today, right?
You're absolutely right on target, and really you notice the nuance of shift that's taking place. We are going to be bitter clingers because we're technologists. We're going to hold on to our app world and our keyboards and our screens. You know, it's just like what Steve did for us, right? I held on to my CD and DVD drive. I said, "How dare you, Steve?" And I've done this a lot with Steve. How dare you take my SCSI port away from me? How dare you take my USB bus and what all the? You know what happens is we start shifting, and all of a sudden we realize that we don't need a DVD player anymore when everything's in a cloud. We don't need to buy a CD anymore or record, unfortunately, because it's all in the cloud. And this is what's going to start happening with apps. So the subscription model that Phil Schiller talked about prior to the WWDC was very important to get that out there, because my belief system is that these intents and domains are going to become subscriptions more than the app is going to become a download. And that's going to be the new model. You're going to expand the capabilities of Siri within certain domains, and you're going to be happy to pay for that because it's going to be such a rich environment. And so Apple had to create a new paradigm on how developers can get enriched in this environment to work hard to build these capabilities and to continue to maintain them, because it's a living and breathing thing. Billions of people ultimately using it. There's changes and shifts, and it's gonna need some self maintenance, but certainly some external maintenance. And so the new paradigm is appless. I believe ultimately Apple will have a voice OS along with iOS, and that gets even more down the rabbit hole of macabre and bizarre. But it's not much different than what iOS is to OS X or Mac OS, right? Because really, they're the same OS. And, you know, I discovered that clearly using Siri before the event, where I asked Siri, I said, "Siri, open the settings window." And she came back with an error message I was anticipating. I don't have a Finder app to do that. Right. And that was my clear signaling a couple of almost a week before WWDC that it's definitely coming to macOS because it uses that particular service in OS 10. But you know, a voice OS is going to be completely non-dependent upon a screen, and the screen is going to be ephemeral, maybe physically ephemeral in the sky in the screen, you know, floating in front of you, but ephemeral in a sense that it will be there only when you need it, only when you must have visual confirmation of something. But it turns out you really don't need visual confirmation of things as much as you think you do.
Right.
Ultimately, like when you're ordering an Uber, you don't really need to. All you need is Siri to say Uber's 3.5 minutes away or 2 minutes away. You don't need – the map is pretty. It's very cool to see the icon inside of the iMessage even because now it's a rich format within iMessage. But ultimately, you don't care. You say order, you know, get me an Uber or get me a pizza or whatever. And food ordering is a good example. I did a lot of that over the last 6 months on Twitter. I was showing how Siri and Alexa, even working together, can order food. You and I are much more acclimated to ordering food with our voice than we are going through apps. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, everybody says, well, Brian, why would I use my voice when I can open up the pizza app? And I always do the contest. I go, let's go. Siri, order me a pizza. Boom, I'm done. This guy is just opening the app.
Right.
Or let's use a classic one I use with Alexa, and I want to use with Siri more. Alexa, what's my commute look like? I commute to the south part of Temecula. It's a 20-minute ride. If it says that it's going to be 30 minutes, I didn't need a map to tell me there's traffic.
Right.
Now, if you try to duplicate that with your thumbs, there's cognitive load, mental load, and mechanical load, that movement of your thumbs moving through the apps. And I don't care how fast you are, you will never beat that capability. So that's some of the intelligence that's going to come. So yes, the apps are going to become more... the domains that they are capable of and the intent extractions that they can achieve from those domains. And then Siri is going to mediate that. And that's why it's limited to messaging, phone calls, photo search, ride booking, P2P payments, and workouts. That's all that Siri Kit can do officially as we stand today. But by no means is it going to be limited to that. It's limited to that because Siri has tremendous amount of intelligence specifically around messages and phone calls. And so sharing that intelligence to, another text device like Snapchat or Twitter or something like that, easy to do. Phone calls, very easy to get VoIP, systems like maybe a WeChat or anything like that into the lock screen. And I don't want to pass by how important the new lock screen is going to be in iOS 10 because it's really part of this appless world, because you're less and less going to go to the app. You're more and more going to deal with notifications from right. those apps and interactions. And the rich notification layer that's coming to the lock screen, profoundly important. But that's a bit of a side to the voice first revolution that's coming along that's leading this way.
Well, so let's talk a little bit more about that. So Siri, you hit kind of the highlights of what Siri could do at WWDC. So what I'm curious from your perspective is, has Apple put in enough? Is there anything else that's needed right now that you think they
yes.
kind of missed? I mean, did they miss some things with Siri at WWDC?
Yes and no. There's hardware that's missing. The reason why Amazon's Echo and Alexa is so popular and is doing so well is something that's called far-field microphone technology. And this technology, Apple has, and they're using it in a number of systems. They have the leading intelligence. They hired a gentleman away that's working on this. And what the discrimination on what is speech that needs to be worked on versus what is ambient noise and just ongoing conversations, maybe even the television, is very difficult to discern. And it starts with the hardware. It certainly is a whole lot of AI. But in the case of the Echo, there's 7 microphones. There's 6 radial microphones and 1 center microphone. And it does an incredible job in taking information bounced off the walls, this being voice information. It's taking that into a sound file. It's sending it up to the cloud. It's being speech recognized and intent and domain encoded and decoded. And it's acting upon itself so quickly that it's magical. I mean, when you think about all of the work, 99.9% of it is being heavy lifted in the cloud. Same is true to Siri, but in the future, we're going to see Siri do a lot of things locally. So what's missing is a few things. First off, I'm a firm believer Apple's going to be making a voice-first device looking very much like Alexa. Not physically, but looking like it from a hardware perspective. Apple HomeKit or Apple Home now is one of the excuses to do this. That is another advancement that is going to cement voice because it, you know, the voice will be harbored within your home and you'll be able to do a whole lot more with it than even you could see with Alexa right now, and a whole lot easier. If you see some of the demonstrations and some of the work I've been doing within Xcode and some of the kits that they have out there, it is extremely powerful. I mean, these are things that people have been dreaming about doing with home automation, Internet of Things, and that's also plays into voice first. What does it look like? It could be the Apple TV. All you need to do is put far-field mics on an Apple TV box, and you have Alexa instantly. There's no, and it has a TV screen attached and all the other things. So it's not a difficult thing from hardware. The limitation of Siri today is really, I can only contrast it negatively in a sense on how Viv approaches how the system learns. In Viv, there's less coding and more learning. You're literally training Viv like you would a child by repetition, by laying out these intents and domains, and it builds literally neurons, if you will. There really are artificial neurons that have multiple connections to a particular subject. For example, if the first thing you ever had was applesauce, that goes back to a whole neuron or a whole set of ontologies that connect to applesauce. So if I say applesauce to you, it might remind you of your mom. It might remind you of you being in a high chair. It might have something that has nothing to do with applesauce. That's how neuronal connections take place. You can't do that in the structured environment that you currently have within Alexa and Siri. This will change, but Viv is way down the road when it comes to that. I don't put out of the possibility of Viv and Apple being realigned again at some point, or maybe not, but maybe Apple will do it. So it's limited in a case that, as I said, the domains right now are five. Messages to workouts, to ride sharing. By the time the fall comes, it'll probably be more like 35, maybe 40. And I have a good idea what those are going to be.
Right.
A lot of them are going to be commerce related. And as I said before, in this new modality, commerce is an end result of a lot of our searches, or commerce could be. And what used to subsidize that was advertising, Google pay-per-click advertising specifically. In this new world, ontologies of the potentials of buying things will fit in there, but it's not going to be an advertising model, a push model, right? We're used to, our entire life has been push advertising on the TV, on radio, on magazines, on newspapers, billboards. Pay-per-click even is push advertising to a certain extent. Siri and voice-first systems, we will not tolerate our best friend, because these intelligent agents will become our best friend.
Right.
We're not going to tolerate them breaking into, hey, would you like to use Downy today?
Right.
Spring soft Downy. You know, you won't do that.
If your favorite pizza place is Pizza Hut, you don't want her suggesting, oh, wouldn't you rather use Domino's?
Yeah, exactly. And Domino's has a 10% discount and buy one, get one free. No, but in all of this, the entire world is being shaken up, literally, because I believe it will, but a lot of people still think it, if the voice first world of zero push advertising comes to play and it dominates, and Apple is going to see that it does. This is part of the war that they have with Facebook and Google to some level about privacy, really, is what is all predicated upon. If it does dominate, everything that we do with the way we discover products and the way we recommend products to our friends and family is going to dramatically change. And some of the anticipation social signaling was predicted to become. A lot of people thought social commerce would have taken off by now. And the reason why is there hasn't been the proper metaphor for it to work. Intelligent agents that are acting upon your behalf, and I notate that there are S's next to agents, not one, but many, that are acting upon your behalf are going to use social signaling as a way to replace advertising. And that's going to build itself into this voice commerce, voice payments world. And it sounds quite bizarre if you haven't been in this for a while. Right. I'm so used to an agent speaking to each other. I've done some videos where, you know, you have Siri and Alexa talking, right? But what really is behind the scene is 12 to 50, in some cases, Raspberry Pis that are operating intelligent agents to develop the formatted questions to talk to these voice-first systems. So today, the intelligent agent can't mentally separate the intelligent agent from the system. When we talk to Siri, we think we're talking to an intelligent agent. Now, right. The intelligent agent is going to be us. Hopefully, it's in the secure enclave. And Apple has something called differential privacy, which I can go into in a little bit.
Yeah.
This all is related to our AI and Siri, specifically leading that AI, learning a whole heck of a lot more about us than maybe even our spouses might know.
So I want to talk about that a little bit because, and you alluded to this earlier, and this is definitely where I want to maybe get into and maybe where we'll wrap up a little bit. But it seemed to me, coming out of WWDC, Siri gained a lot of capabilities, but didn't get all that much smarter, right? And I was really hoping to see, as you mentioned, some of the learning stuff. Because Apple has these companies, as you alluded to at the very beginning of this conversation, you have a whole, you know, core thing on this about, you know, and goes into some of the things you were talking about with Focal IQ, right? Apple has acquired a lot of technologies and companies that it would seem they could use those technologies to make Siri much smarter and become better at, you know, doing this, you know, learning more about us and knowing more about us and then being able to take that intelligence and use it in a very smart way. But it seems like Apple didn't show that off, and maybe that was deliberate. I think it's not that they don't have it, but I also often wonder if their balance of security and privacy is maybe slowing down that development, or is that just an outsider not really understanding the technology?
That's a really good analysis here. Let me back it up into payments once again. Everybody would argue with me about payments and NFC and Apple being involved as a payment mediator. I said the very first thing that they need to do is secure the iPhone. And we have to make sure that that iPhone is more secure than anything that we own. And in a lot of cases, it is.
Yeah, I think they've done a good job on that.
So that was the acquisition of Touch ID, right? So they got Touch ID. That was, you know, a year and a half, 2 years before they announced anything having to do with Apple Pay, maybe even 2 years. Right. And immediately, the day they came out, you know, I knew about Touch ID for a long time, and they were shopping that company, and everybody, Google said no, Samsung said no, Apple said yes. You know, they literally were shopping the company. It was bizarre that nobody wanted that incredible patented technology. And, you know, when the day it was announced, I said, this is Apple's first move into Apple Payments. I would call it the iWallet back then because I was fixated on the i
sure.
naming
so
metaphor.
Was Apple. So was
yeah,
Apple.
Yeah, so was Apple. Yeah, you know, and anyway, Eddie changed that. But what we're looking at now is, what does Apple need to do to make voice commerce work? The very first thing they need to do is get us really convinced, and not only convinced, but really secure about the fact that everything they do moving forward, and this has a lot to do with the debates that took place over the last 8 to 10 months about unlocking phones and privacy and all that. If, in fact, if you notice right now, Siri on macOS is not always on like Alexa.
Right.
It's push to talk. This is a big, big thing. Once Apple breaches the ground from push to talk to always on, we wind up changing things. It ultimately will always be always on. That's the direction this is going in. But I got to tell you, I'm on the frontier of this stuff. I look at what Alexa records. I look at what Siri records. I have my own mechanism that I do with that. But Alexa, literally, Amazon shows you the snippets. And it's horrifying how that could be utilized and what could be acted upon, that data set of listening to private conversations continuously. I'm not accusing Amazon of doing that. I have Alexa in my car, in my bathroom, bedroom, library, kitchen. It's everywhere. And, you know, so, but I use it in a very powerful way. but I'm concerned. So what is Apple doing? They created a an environment where you can feel secure, and they brought about a statistical analysis system called differential privacy. It's been around for a long time. It's not an Apple naming convention. It's not right. something they came up with. It's been around within the AI community and the statistics community for a very long time. So the best way I can say how this works is if I were to take a picture of the Statue of Liberty, and let's just say 1 million people take a picture of it, we can statistically draw something from me sending just a group of pixels. Maybe my group of pixels is the flame, but it doesn't have location data. That's cool. Now, that might be anonymized partial data, and some people might be fine with that. Apple's not fine with that. They do one step further, and this is what differential privacy is about. They flip a coin on whether they're going to lie, whether one pixel is on or off or blue or green. They're just flipping a coin, and there's a possible randomness. It's completely random, done on your local device, on whether or not it's telling the truth to the greater set that's going to be analyzed. Now, that sounds bizarre, but statistically, if you get enough people doing it, you can derive some commonality of what the Statue of Liberty looks like. You'll do it with a high degree of accuracy, and you'll be able to draw analysis that a whole lot of people took a picture of the Statue of Liberty, were analyzing that it was probably a sum of X by doing that. You can never back out of that equation and figure out who was actually there, what they actually took a picture of. Now, that's a very simple general capability of what differential privacy does.
Right.
But imagine that on a mass scale of everything you wind up saying to your computer. All of this data has got to be reported because, in a sense, how can Siri learn unless it learns, unless it understands what you just did? And the only way it can do that is by assembling hundreds and thousands, millions of requests that are similar and de-emphasizing where it came from and more emphasizing on it. Now, anonymousness is a little different. That is maybe the Google model where somebody is saying, here's a location, here's a picture, here's all the metadata, but just don't attach my name to it.
Right.
Well, you know, maybe someday somebody can reverse that out, and maybe you don't want to be advertised or marketed to that level. And maybe it gets to a point where it gets ridiculous, and that's what Apple's planning on. So differential privacy takes a little bit more time. Differential privacy also makes Siri learn a little slower than one would under other circumstances. In some cases, and that's more about not intent extraction as much as domain extraction, because intent is easier to follow once you get down into this rabbit hole programming it. And that's why we're limiting the domains it can activate on. And that's why developers are a necessary part of making Siri more robust, because Apple could sit there and program every single domain, but it, you know, it's just like Apple could write every single app. But what creates the richness of the Apple ecosystem beyond any other ecosystem is that developers' creativity is crowdsourced, and you have people coming up with use cases nobody could imagine. But once you unleash this incredible power, you got to make sure that you're protecting everybody in the process. And that's what Apple's doing, saying, okay, yes, we acquired Vocal IQ, and it can do a whole lot of powerful things. And Emotient can decode emotions to a level that not even your spouse can by using micro muscle indication.
Right, this is the facial recognition technology.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and facial recognition and what I call emotional decoding is going to become profoundly important to understanding you and your intent in Vocal IQ and vocal-driven AI.
Right.
Because, you know, you and I are talking over Skype, but if we were physically talking, I can enumerate a lot more of my gesticulations with my face, my arms, and all these other things.
Sure. And also you can read cues from me too, right? You can't tell right now if I'm very interested or bored.
Bored right? Out of your head. Exactly. And
I'm very interested, by the way.
I hope so. You know, but
that's the point, right? Is if a vocal system can see those things, it can react in different ways, even though the phrasing might be identical, right? That you may say the same thing, and we all know this as humans, but you don't think about it with machine learning or machine reaction, right, is the same phrase could mean two different things depending upon facial cues or body cues or gesture cues.
Irony is a good example. It's very hard to, and that's why we have so many fights on the social media world, is that right. People really don't understand ironic humor. In fact, it's hard to decode in person, let alone, you have to kind of know a little bit about the person that's giving the ironic humor, because they can, you can almost assume they actually mean what they're saying.
Right.
You know, on the internet, you might use an emoticon, and that might even inflame somebody more and trigger them into saying, what do you really mean? What are you laughing at me? So what is even more important is there are micro movements between one emotional state and another. And to fully understand what a human is saying, those transient emotions, as you're, you know, saying these words and developing the next word that you're going to say, are going to be exceedingly important. It is scary. I know some people are starting to get triggered by fear here. Yes, you should be. Don't think twice about it. There is some scary aspects to all this AI, especially emotional reading. If in fact your device, your intelligent agent, can decode your true emotions better than your spouse, because it's fixated on micro movements and micro emotions that the incredible research done by the scientists that put this together in the 70s and 80s. I'm a student of all this research, so I've studied it. It's incredibly powerful. And a lot of people thought of it as being a woo-woo science. Paul Ekman is the leader of this. He's a California scientist, researcher, and he was laughed at when this first came out. This was back in the 70s. Oh, you can't decode emotions. There's no transitionary states between one emotion and another. And people don't give, a lot of people use this as a lie detector, and that's one of the uses Paul has demonstrated. And it certainly is accurate, but it also does give deep insight on what a person's doing. So all these things are going to come and merge. And, you know, it's all going to happen at a pace that I think is going to be a little bit faster than even the technologists that are leading it are expecting, because there's orders of magnitude of machine learning that's going to be taking place and unleashed. And getting back to that question about Apple in the background, right, doing a lot of stuff, in the background, Siri has actually gotten smarter. But it's been, I know it because I'm a researcher within voice, and I know that just in the last 6 months, its abilities have skyrocketed and its accuracy has skyrocketed. Also, its humor. And there's a different implementation. Google has decided not to name their device or their system.
Right.
It's called Google Home, which I think, I wrote a piece on Medium and Quora about this, what I think the anthropomorphisms that humans use, it's necessary that we name these things, and Google's making a big mistake. But Google's also decided to have zero humor in their system. Zero irony, zero humor, and everybody thinks that's more efficient. The problem is, as these systems of artificial intelligence and our intelligent assistants become more closer, the humor aspect of humans is extremely important. Yep. We can't exist without it. And here's what happens. Once you get close enough to your devices, you stop, like the very first thing that most people do when they have a voice first device like Alexa or Siri is they shout at it like it's hard of hearing and maybe it's a little dumb. And over time, you'll start noticing that you have almost dialogues with the systems, and when they start answering back, and that's where Siri is going to be by the fall, you start seeing much more of a dialogue experience more than a question and answer experience. These connector words and hums and ums and maybe, yep, some humor along the way. That's coming. It's coming to Viv also in a different way, and it's necessary for these systems to be useful. And I know that a lot of us technologists and programmers say, no big deal, I just want the facts. No, you don't. In the real world, you want these interactions because they make them much more richer and much more rewarding. And you're going to find that with our voice-first systems.
I think if you want to see exactly what you're talking about and how important it is, you know, us old fuddy-duddies, like, you know, who are used to a mouse and keyboard and visual inputs and things like that, right? We're slow to get the change. And we think about these things like what you just said and think, oh, poppycock, that's crazy. We're not going to talk to our machines that way. You know, they're so inhuman and stuff like that. Give Siri to a child, and my kids do this all the time, and I watch them and I get fascinated, right? Is I'll show them something, you know, some kitschy little thing that I found out about online, you know, ask Siri this. And then immediately after that, they will start to try and have all of these conversations. And they do get a little bit frustrated, you know, with the question and answer nature of Siri right now. Like they want to, you can see them want to have that interaction and they're very comfortable with it. You know, it's like they're having a conversation with their friend or something like that. And they're expecting these responses back. When they don't come back, it's a little frustrating. But I think you're right. I think, you know, it's going to become more conversational. And the next generation, because they're growing up with this kind of technology, I see, you know, they're going to be totally comfortable talking to, you know, we feel weird and awkward. And people say, well, I don't use Siri. And I think even some studies came out recently saying that, you know, a lot of people don't use Siri because they don't feel, you know, comfortable or they feel awkward or, you know, but that's going away very,
you know,
quickly.
we got to cover this. There was something around the turn of the century that started called telephonophobia. Now, it sounds like one of these things that somebody actually made up. It literally was an affliction that people had from the early 1900s to the 1930s. There were people that of that generation that could not have a conversation to a box. Right. They could not talk into a box without seeing somebody. And that's why the very first phones in the United States literally had two bells that looked like eyes. And the nose was sort of the mouthpiece.
Right,
And the thing up to the ear. And that you kind of, they kind of yelled into it like the person was hard of hearing again. Sounds familiar.
Yeah, right.
And they were staring. If you look at old films, they literally were staring at the two bells like their eyes. And the thing is, children have really informed this. I got the Alexa system because Alexa is really more, to me at today, more of an example of how children really interact. Once we set up Alexa in the kitchen, my wife actually got it first because Amazon was smart to send it to high-density Prime users. My wife outpaces me by a landmark. They didn't send it out to technologists. That's why it wasn't on the roadmap for a lot of the technical insiders to write about. So we got it in 2014, immediately was in the kitchen. So at that time, I had a five-year-old and a nine-year-old. And it became instantly a hit for them for all kinds of things, ordering things. So we already immediately understood security and passwords and protection. Right. I got a lot of intellectual capital, actually, in patents that I'm filing related to that. And also the learning aspect. I am fully, Adam, I'm fully convinced that we are going to have an intelligent agent follow us from childhood on to adult, and they're going to be our teacher as much as our assistant. And what it literally brings tears to my eyes right now, I walked in into the kitchen and my son was there. He's doing really well and he's 5 years old. And he was having that dialogue that you were talking about with Alexa. And I sat down, it was dark where I was in the living room and he was in the kitchen. And I just listened to, and he was going on and asking about advanced math questions, stuff that, you know, in some ways I wish he would have asked me, but he was just rattling them off. And I videotaped almost 15 minutes of this unending conversation about, so what is a differential equation? He was 5 years old. What is a differential equation then? And instead of saying, here, I found this on the web, that was Siri one. We don't want that. Alexa started to explain it. And then it went on to, he went on to, well, can you explain theory of relativity? And then Alexa said, well, there are two forms of relativity. I will, you know, and explain it. And he was transfixed. This is powerful, powerful stuff. And, you know, we spent a whole lot of time talking about the cameras, but, you know, with senior citizens and young children, this is not a replacement. I hope not. You know, I mean, we're all busy. We're working harder. Economy's a drag on people. You know, the American family's tough because you have to have two people working, et cetera, and certainly around the world. But having this special friend, if you will, that just sort of gets you and understands the nuances of your questions by the nature of your prior questions, that this there's an ongoing dialogue that can go on. So if the intelligence was there with Alexa, she would have remembered that he already asked about relativity and could kind of pick up where that was left off in a very, very profoundly important way. So I believe education in the next 10 years is going to be profoundly impacted by this voice-driven AI, and it is going to be something I ultimately hope is great. You know, I hope it's not a replacement for real teachers, but I see that as being a powerful effect. Sure. But yeah, we strayed far from the farm of what happened at WWDC.
Well, no, this is where I wanted to go. So kind of just to bring it back a little ways, but I don't even think this is WWDC related. This is just more, the last question I want to ask you is future of the technology. You know, obviously, there's a lot of companies doing this. We've mentioned Google and Amazon and Viv and Apple. They're all looking at AI. They're all looking at voice systems. They're all doing their own different implementations. You know, I'm kind of curious. You almost want to say who's going to win, but I'm not sure there is winners and losers per se. I mean, how does this all come together? How do you see the future? You know, obviously you're an Apple fan, but, you know, it sounds like you've played a lot with Alexa too.
Yeah.
And a lot of, I guess where I'm wondering about this is more specifically, you know, there's a lot of people out there sort of spouting that, you know, Amazon is in the lead on this and Apple is way behind, you know, so what is that reality? Is there, are there winners or losers? Is Apple going to, you know, win in this game? Do they have to win in this game? You know, those are, I know that's a lot of general questions.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thinking that I'm thinking. What do you think? What do you see as the future?
I gotta start with a metaphor. You and I are on Plymouth Rock, and it's this late, maybe mid 1600s, and we're looking at this big continent that we quote unquote discovered. Of course, there are people there, but let's, for all intent and purposes, we discovered it, right? So we're looking across this great plain, and we can't even imagine what the Mississippi River looks like, let alone the Pacific Ocean or the Grand Canyon.
Sure.
And we, you and I might have this argument: how many cities are going to be out there? And we're going to, oh, 5, 10. No, that's crazy. 10. Europe doesn't have 10 big cities, you know? I mean, that's kind of the thing that we would... In reality, what really happened? Thousands of cities, maybe, you know, dozens and dozens of very big cities, but thousands of reasonable-sized cities, and all kinds of wealth. You know, you and I might be running down the river basin saying, look, I found gold. No, I found silver. I found platinum. What's that? I don't know. I found buffalo. You know, I found gooses. You know, all kinds of wealth, and we're trying to put something around it as a definition of winning and losing. What I'm really saying here is I think all these technologies are going to flourish. I think they're going to do some things much, much better than others, and we'll be more pleased to use that disembodied spirit. Because my thesis is Alexa is already disembodied. It can go on a Raspberry Pi. It can move on to other computer systems. That's Wise of Amazon. Certainly Viv is disembodied by its nature. It isn't initially designed for any hardware. And I believe Siri and a lot of Apple platforms are going to move on to other systems like Android and Microsoft. It's hard for people to imagine that hardware becomes less of a thing, but it will, because Moore's Law always said that hardware would be commoditized to the point where it became irrelevant. That the only thing that matters at that point is a service layer that's on top of it. We currently call that apps and software and OS, but
sure,
it's the experience. So what is going to happen, like I said before, is we're going to have an intelligent agent that hopefully you own. I'm a big advocate of owning our intelligent agent, who then mediates our experience to these intelligent systems, voice AI systems, or even textual AI, maybe in bots. I don't like ever using the word bot because it really doesn't describe what these things are doing from a...
I think agent is a great word for that.
Yes. Yeah. But even that has baggage from early Apple Newton Navigator.
Knowledge Navigator.
But that was actually a good John Scully video. I go back to it a lot to inspire me. But I believe that all of these things are going to coexist, and we're going to love it. We're going to say, we're not going to say, oh my God, I got to go to Windows, or I got to, all of those, the drudgeries of using computers are going to be erased. You know, oh, I got to go to an Android device. I love OS, iOS. It's going to be more like, you know, Google is really good in this domain. We might actually wind up using this terminology, and I'm going to use Google for this, or, you know, Apple's awesome in this, or, you know, maybe a multitude of these things, but I really believe we're going to have all of them surrounding us. And I got to say, in a garage right now is the, let's call it the Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak hacking away at the next Apple of this voice first technology world. And even though I just said that the hardware doesn't matter, in the first iterations, it's going to matter immensely because of the far-field technology. we want to be able to shout to our devices when we feel like it. The only way you can do that effectively is with a multitude of microphones, with a whole lot of data science, cross cancellation of signal and all this kind of stuff. And I have already seen some stealth companies that are doing incredible here. A lot of them are very young. They're younger than the founders that we normally find in startups. They're not the 35-year-olds or 25-year-olds. They're people in high school. I've sat down with people who have tremendous ideas, and a lot of it goes to what you said before, Adam, is our children have no barriers in adapting this stuff much quicker. Right. And it's so easy to lose track on how cemented we've become to learn these arcane languages. You and I, even if we don't ever learn a program, already learned arcane languages of computerese to even interact with, you know, touch gestures on an iOS device. We had to learn to do that. Albeit it was maybe not as much learning as maybe an Android or Windows device, but it is learning nonetheless. We're going to do less of that, and we're going to get about the business of actually getting things done more. And I think we have everybody winning to a certain extent, but I do think on the same regard, we're going to see startups come out of the woodwork with new AI and machine learning technologies that are outside the bounds of academia, because everybody thinks this is all academia. That's what they said about COBOL and Fortran and C and Unix. Oh, these are and the internet, you know. And you get back to the UI, and I gotta bring this up. One of the earliest fist fights I've ever gotten with a technologist was somebody who was a DOS fan, and I was at a conference at Comdex, and I stood up and I said, you know, the Macintosh interface is really going to wind up taking off over the metaphor.
Meaning, and it was the GUI, right?
Yes, the graphic user interface. And the Mac had just come out. I was with John Dvorak. It was a great time. And there were a lot of really very vehement deniers of this. And this gentleman came up to my face and he said, I am not going to give up my CPU clock cycles to move pretty pictures around a screen. Do you know how much energy that's going to waste on my CPU? How much memory I'm going to waste just so it looks cute? I have a command line and I can do everything. We're going to have that. And anyway, that I said something I guess he thought it was unkind. It wasn't. And he punched me in the face right in front of a whole group of people and was proud of it. And he said, no, command lines will rule. And, you know, obviously nobody's using that to a greater extent. I'd still use a command line, ironically. But
yeah, so do a lot of people. And again, I think that's another great point, though, is, you know, as you mentioned, especially in these transitory periods, but even long term, there are going to be instances where, you know, you will need a UI. You will need some visual verification or interaction. It's just they become minimized or changed or take a lesser role.
Exactly. That's why it's not voice only. I say voice first. Right. And I came up with voice first primarily because it's 140 characters on Twitter. And I conversational commerce is too many words and all this other stuff. So, yes. You know, this is sounding utopian because in some ways it is, because for 50 years we had to learn what to be like a computer is. You know, we had to try to punch cards. We had to have holes in cards and switches and then tape drives and all this other metaphors and a mouse and all these other things. They started getting closer, you touch user interfaces. But finally, we're going back to where it all was supposed to have been to begin with. The ability to say, hey, what's going on the baseball game? Well, you know, what baseball game? It knows, right? What's going on here?
The most basic interaction that we've had since the birth of man, right?
Exactly, exactly. And so that is utopian. The other side of it is we're giving up a tremendous amount of our privacy in some regard, no matter what, even with differential privacy, to get this stuff done. So what we are all facing, everybody listening to us now, is going to be alive during a transformative period where we're going to be arguing these things very, very vehemently. And we're going to be arguing about how this augments reality, because voice first is augmented reality. Just like visual augmented reality, this is audio augmented reality. It's an overlay to your world. And what virtual reality might become. I'm a believer of all those augmented realities, but I just don't think VR and AR are going to be as profoundly important as what voice is going to wind up doing to our world. And
that may
but
be
that's
a whole separate
be,
conversation we have to come back to.
Oh yeah, because these things are all going to interact, because they're all augmentations
sure.
to what we're used to. But that's the beginning of Apple. I mean, Apple started this whole thing, you know, almost 5 years ago with a phone call from Steve Jobs. And we have the beginnings of that finally taking hold. And it's immensely important to understand the patience that Apple has to get everything done the right way. Sometimes right. they move so slow, it seems like things aren't even happening. And then all of a sudden, boom, there's a reason to buy a new iPhone. I promise you, the iPhone 7, everybody is saying that there's no reason to update. You will want to own an iPhone 7. There's a lot of reasons why. And it's hard for us to imagine how the future is going to change. But Apple's been able to do that pretty effectively. And they're one of the most successful companies in history because of that. It won't only be Apple, but the hardware is still going to play an important part over the next 10 years. Sure. I got to tell you, 20 years from now, it's not going to matter as much. We're not going to care what the hardware platform is like. It's going to be universal.
All right. I think we're going to leave it there. That's a great place to close it up. I do want to give you a final chance because I would really like people to go check out your work and the stuff you've been doing. Like I said, I've just recently discovered your stuff and I'm still drilling and there's a wealth of stuff out there. So if people do want to sort of follow along, see what you're writing about, what you're up to, what's the best place they can go do that and let them know anything else you want them to know about you and your work.
Well, thank you, Adam. And I really appreciate that. I'm a researcher. I started with physics. I learned science from that. I'm an empirical researcher. I go out and do stuff. So all the stuff that I've been doing with voice, I've actually been literally doing with voice. And, you know, I wrote a manifesto in 1989 about voice and it's 800 pages now. It was supposed wow. to be 5 pages. It's supposed to be 5. But, you know, what I am doing is I'm trying to understand what the future is going to look like. And I do that by actually taking little adventures up to the mountainside and saying, one day I'm going to climb that mountain. So in the future, I might be leading some of this stuff within maybe some of the companies we're talking about, maybe as a startup. I don't know. But I do tweet a bit. I'm known to tweet. My first and last name is usually how you find me on social media. I don't Facebook very often. Quora, you can go to Quora and look me up. I've written a lot there, body of work. On Medium, I'm starting to do a lot more on Medium because it's easier to share. So Twitter, Medium, and stuff like that. I'm going to continue to do little projects. Payfinders is a hobby right now. It might become something more. I got about 9 hobbies I'm going to release apps for. Some may be related to voice and some may be related to payments. And I'm going to continue to do my research. What I'm working on today, for example, is I have new dialogues between Siri and Alexa. I'm very, very big on using both of these systems to talk to each other and to find new insights about data. That's my API. Yeah. The API, the future is our voice.
Sure. You're posting a lot of stuff on, again, like you said, on Medium. So it's Brian Romley, R-O-E-M-M-E-L-E.
That's right. B-R-I-A-N, no Y.
oh, yeah. I guess there are. Yeah. So
yeah.
I'll link to your Medium stuff and your Quora and your Twitter in the show notes so people can find you. But there's some great videos. You know, I loved the video on using Siri and the Echo and voice commerce and stuff like that. So I'm going to let the audience go check all that stuff out for themselves. And again, thank you so much for agreeing to come on. This was fascinating and a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Adam, thank you so much. And I always hear, and to anybody who wants to reach out to me, I answer. I really want to hear what you have to say. So message me. I'll get back to you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks a lot, Adam. You take care.
So there you go, Brian Romley. What a great guy, huh? And very smart on all of this stuff. I think he had a great phrase on one of his Quora things. He said, you know, I'm not an expert. I am just a really good student or a continuing student. Always learning, always expanding the skills. And I think we're all like that, right? We all want to know more. We all want to expand our skills. We are forever students. And I think that's just a great analogy for what's going on. And so you really should check out Brian's writings. Like I said, I will make sure all the links to all of the things he is doing are in the show notes at maccast.com. I think this is an area really to follow. I think it's really the next big thing, the AI, voice first, as Brian calls it, or voice interfaces. That's going to be the next frontier in how we work with computers and how we work with technology. And it's going to be very interesting to see it expanding. I'm also curious, you know, how all the VR sort of stuff works into that as well, and certainly is going to be a part of it, I think, as Brian alluded to. And I thank him for his time. That was a lot of fun. If you have any feedback for me or Brian, you can reach out to Brian directly, you know, through his website and through his writings and stuff like that. But I'm also happy to pass along questions. If you want to make a comment, you heard something you want to expand on yourself, or maybe got your ideas flowing, that's what this is all about. It's our community being able to exchange ideas and concepts and sort of think about this stuff so that we can all come to a better understanding. And I think that that was great. I really, really enjoyed it. So I hope you did as well. But that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label. Also, check out Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by going to smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can always email me or drop your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or you can leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or you can check us out on Google Plus. The Google Plus community can be found at google.com/plusMacCast. And that's the plus symbol. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, happy Father's Day for those fathers out there. And I will talk to you all again real soon.